a bit of the history of thermal physics. People try to measure temperature well before they knew what temperature was. So let's begin with the ancient Greek. So Galenos or Galen said that we can divide all the temperature we know by nine parts. So he took the coldest stuff he knew about, which was ice, and the hottest stuff he knew about, which was boiling water, and took an equal mixture. He didn't know what does it mean. Is it equal weight or volume? But he called this the neutral point. And put 4 points on each side. So let's begin the modern stuff. In early 17th century, people invented the thermometer, but it's not very clear who did so. Historians give credits to four people. The first is famous, is Galileo. And then is Santoria, and Vlad, and Drevo. It's probably more interesting to see what they made than who did that. So the first drawing of a thermometer is probably like this. It's called an air thermometer. We take two flasks and connect them together. So it's like this. We put some liquid here. There is probably a bit gas here and and gas here. And when the temperature rises, the gas expands and the boundary goes down. Then people invented the so-called liquid in glass thermometer. Now, this is based on the expansion of the gas, and the liquid in glass is based on the expansion of the liquid. So there are actually two kinds of them. The first is familiar to most of us, probably. It's like this. Here it can be vacuum or some nitrogen, and here we have some liquid. And when we heat the thing, the boundary goes up. And one liquid glass. One more fancy one is like this. We still have liquid, but let's say we want to measure temperature near the room temperature. And we take some liquid whose density depends on the temperature, and take some balls or stuff like that whose density is clear to close to this density. So some will flow, some will sink, and when the temperature goes up, this density goes down, and maybe this ball can also goes up. So that's the thermometers I'm going to I talked about, and let's talk about a bit of history. Unfortunately, the first history we made is quite wrong. It's a caloric theory. It's promoted by Lavoisier, and it's probably due to his famousness that this persisted for a long time. He says like heat is a kind of matter, and there's a kind of fluid called the caloric. The first man who found a serious flaw of the theory is probably Benjamin. Thompson. He's later called Count Rumford. He was in charge of boring cannon barrels, and he found that when that was done, the cannon barrels were heated, and he tried to measure how much heat he can get from us. He put that thing in water and found the heat he can get was more or less infinite. And that's absurd if we try to explain in the caloric theory, since if we think the heat is a kind of liquid from the cannon barrel, then it should not be infinite. But his work was more or less ignored at that time, and we now give credit to to finding the first law of thermodynamics to three other people. So, Lauren will tell you what the first law is, or I think you know what it is. So there are Mayer, Joe, and Helmholtz. Mayer was motivated by some of the observation in physiology, and also he was a physician, a boat, and the navigator told him that in a storm the temperature of the ocean water increases. So that's another motivation. And Joule did a lot of experiments to measure the mechanical equivalent of heat. The most accurate one is probably he pushed water through a thin tube and found that the temperature of that increased. And then Helmholtz is probably motivated by that there is no perpetual motion machine possible. And at early time, people was not very clear about the difference between the temperature and internal energy, and it was Black who found that when he melted ice, the temperature can be constant when he does that. So he found the difference between T temperature and the internal energy, although he called this the intensity of the heat and this the quantity of the heat. Okay, that's all I have. Lauren will tell you more about thermodynamics.
Okay, so as Peifeng said, I'm going to talk to you about the laws of thermodynamics and how they relate to temperature. Okay, so before I can give a definition of temperature, I just want to quickly go over the definition of a state variable. So a set of state variables is used to fully describe a system's state. It doesn't depend on the system's past history, and it can be used to fully predict the system's future. So there are some examples I can give. Some of them we haven't defined yet, but they'll come to be defined later in my presentation. So examples would be pressure, volume. Those are intensive variables. And then we also have things such as internal energy, temperature. Oh, sorry, this is not true, sorry. Temperature is intensive. Then, sorry, extensive ones would be internal energy, volume, and entropy. Next, one more definition we need is the definition of thermal equilibrium. So two systems are in thermal equilibrium if there is no heat being exchanged between the systems, and also if there are no changes to these state variables happening. So from here, I can give the zeroth law of thermodynamics, which is then used to give a definition of temperature. So the zeroth law of thermodynamics says that if we have three systems, A, B, and C, and if A and B are in thermal equilibrium, and B and C are also in thermal equilibrium, then A and C are also in thermal equilibrium. So as I mentioned, from here, we see a way to relate temperature to thermal equilibrium. And so by definition, if we have a set of systems that are all in thermal equilibrium with each other, then we say that they have the same temperature. So now we see how to compare systems as defined with temperature. Now, there's also an interesting way that we can see to relate temperature to other state variables. So the state variables that we can use to describe a system are not all independent. And in particular for a gas, the temperature can be uniquely specified by the pressure and volume. This means that we have some function of P, V, and T that is equal to zero. So we can specify any one of these variables in terms of the other two. Now, as Peifeng mentioned, I'm going to tell you about the first law of thermodynamics. But before I do that, I just want to quickly go over the definitions of heat and work. So heat refers to a non-mechanical exchange of energy between systems or between a system and its surroundings, whereas work, it comes from some kind of a mechanical process. And the change in internal energy of a system comes from changes in heat and changes in work, where this symbol here means that we're dealing with inexact differentials. So they depend on the path that we take. And when we're dealing with a reversible process, we can write this law. We can write the work as negative pressure times the change in volume. OK, so the first law gives us a way of talking about conservation of energy. And it says that changes in energy come from heat and work. So the energy has to be conserved, but the heat and work do not separately have to be conserved. However, what this law doesn't account for is the fact that systems have a preferred direction that they like to go in. So for example, if we have a cold body and a hot body, heat's not going to flow naturally from the cold system to the hot system unless we have some form of external work acting on the system. So to account for this observation, we need the second law of thermodynamics, which says that it's not possible to have a process that only converts heat into work. Now, from this definition, we can eventually arrive at a definition for entropy. We can write a change in entropy as an infinitesimal change in the heat divided by temperature. And this is for a reversible process. If we're dealing with an irreversible process, we get an inequality here. But again, for reversible processes, we can show that the integral over a closed cycle of this quantity has to be zero. And this tells us that this integral is actually path independent. And as I said, this is all for reversible processes. So what this tells us is that even though Q was an inexact differential, when we divide by temperature, we get something with this, which is path independent, which tells us that the temperature actually acts as an integrating factor for our heat and gives us a definition of entropy. And with this definition, we can arrive at the central equation of thermodynamics, which, when we're neglecting changes in the number of particles, is this right here. And again, this is for reversible processes. And now I'm going to pass things off to Robert, and he's going to show you how you can derive some of these equations from principles of statistical mechanics.
Okay, we have to talk about ensembles a bit. Namely, what I want to try to convey you is how all these thermodynamic notions stem from statistical mechanics, from statistical physics, and how I can make this reasoning about thermodynamics, this empirical reasoning, concrete, and derive these laws from statistics on phase space. So if I have a system, I guess, I have a phase space, which is usually extremely high dimensional. N of the order 10 to the 23, or choose a number of your choice, large. So large that we cannot know what exactly the point or what exactly the trajectory of the system is on. So what we have to do is to talk about the macrostate of the system. One point in the phase space is a microstate, but we can only access the macrostate. The reason for this can be various, but let's not just discuss that in 8 minutes. What is a macrostate? Well, a collection of points that have got something in common. For example, the value of a function of state, just as defined in thermodynamics. Function of state can, for example, be the entire energy of a system. How to raise that board? Scroll, manual, rear, front. No, stop. Things are happening. I'm a theoretician. I don't know how to do this. I just want this a bit more up so that Alice can also see what I rewrite. Stop. Thanks. Great. My savior. Okay, where was I? Macrostate. Okay, let's define a macrostate. This can, for example, just be the set of all points for which the Hamiltonian has got the fixed value E. Is a nice macrostate. Now, what is an ensemble? An ensemble can, for example, be a density function on that is supported only on this macrostate. In this case, we're talking about a microcanonical ensemble. This is a system in which the entire energy is conserved. This is just supported on one constant energy hypersurface. And this is mainly the ensemble that I'm going to focus on. Okay, macrostates. In fact, we should talk about equivariant measures on this phase space and their ergodicity properties, but that's not for 8 minutes, and that's a bit too much down the rabbit hole, but another time. Equilibrium, what is equilibrium? Now, in a usual generic thermodynamic system, such as, for example, the gas in this room, there will always be one macrostate which is special, in the case that it takes almost the entire volume of phase space. It's the overwhelmingly large portion. All the other macrostates that can macroscopically be distinguished take way less space. For example, equilibrium density is uniform density. This can just happen in many, many different ways. And the state in which all the molecules are crammed together in that little corner over there has got just a tiny fraction of phase space. So it will practically never happen that all the molecules spontaneously go up there. That is the reason why we can talk about the second law. That is the reason why a system, trajectory of the system, will always spend most of its time in this equilibrium macrostate. OK. Now, in order to deal with volumes in phase space, we should have another quantity about this, because just to make the sizes more tractable, we deal not with the volume of these macrostates, but with logarithm. That's what we call entropy. So with this, I mean the volume, logarithm, and this constant is just a historical accident. Yes, that is entropy. So when we talk about equilibrium state, we talk about the state of maximum entropy. Now I'm going to do something bold. I'm going to define the statistical temperature. Boltzmann entropy derived to energy and that in the equilibrium state. Yeah, one. If somebody walks to you on the street and asks you, what is temperature? This is what you should give him. Now, I owe you something. Namely, we have a notion of temperature, an empirical notion of temperature. Why is this justified? How can we justify this from this abstract definition? Well, I can, for example, show you that the definition as an equivalence relation holds. Let's take a bipartite system. Just a box through which energy cannot go through. And one subsystem can have one energy E1, E2, so that the entire energy is conserved. So this is a microcanonical ensemble. But these two subsystems can exchange energy. In equilibrium, they won't. Let's assume that they are weakly coupled so that the interactions only are there to establish equilibrium. Now what we can derive is that their temperatures are equal. How do we do that? Estimate volumes of phase space. When these are more or less independent, then we can say that the volume of one macrostate is just the volume of this subsystem times the volume of this subsystem, where E2, E1, and E2 have to satisfy this constraint equation. And now we can vary this. This has to be 0 when this is the maximal phase space volume that we're going to talk about. This means that after some song and dance with algebra and product rule itself and stuff, we can derive that dLn omega 1 over dE1 d omega 1 dE1 omega 2 plus d omega 2 or dE2 dE2 omega 1 equal to 0. Now, about these two differentials, we know something, namely that dE1 equal minus dE2. Otherwise, energy would not be conserved. So we can do another song and dance about algebra and then basically arrive at the equation. And all these equations only hold for the equilibrium values of the energy. Wait, we know stuff from there. This means 1 over T1 equal 1 over T2. Pretty easy, pretty cheap, is it not? So this is the front word. When two systems are in thermal equilibrium that can exchange energy, they must have the same temperature. Quod erat demonstrandum. Wonderful. We can do basically the same thing with pressure when they can exchange volume, and then define pressure as ds over dv equal p over t. And then when we do this, this equation is on the board. I'll leave you that as a homework. So the intuition that we should get about temperature here is that temperature controls the average energy in the system, modulo thermic fluctuation. They can always be there. So that we can exchange the quantity of energy as a function of state, which is an extensive quantity, by temperature, which is an intensive quantity. We can label a macrostate by temperature as well. And that means that we transition from the microcanonical ensemble to the canonical ensemble. But I think this is enough to give you the notion that temperature is controlling energy and is sort of a Lagrange multiplier. Also, this can be made concrete, but not in this talk. Thank you. Now, we're going to hear a nice application of all this, namely application to a photon gas.
Yeah, mainly I'll be talking about blackbody radiation, which is just a model that we can use to actually measure temperatures that we cannot physically measure with physical instruments that we have. So actually, we can use blackbody models to measure temperatures of bodies that we cannot actually get access to. Actually, black bodies have bodies that absorb that perfectly absorb electromagnetic radiations that come onto its surface. So because black bodies absorb perfectly every electromagnetic radiations that is inclined towards it, it could also be used as a perfect emitter of every thermal radiations. In considering blackbody radiation, I would like to talk about how we can actually consider a model that can be used to study electromagnetic radiations. And in doing that, we consider an enclosed box in which the walls of the box are opaque, and then the radiations in the box is such that let's assume we have a box like this. So we have an enclosed box like this, and then we consider the radiations which are at thermal equilibrium in this box. So for us to be able to study the electromagnetic radiations in this box, we drill a little hole on this box such that the electromagnetic radiations can be studied. So Planck actually worked on this model, and he came up with the expression for the spectrum, which was the power per unit area actually came up with this expression for this power per unit area, per unit frequency for the electromagnetic radiation of a black body. And considering this, it can be well understood by considering the graphical diagram of a black body electromagnetic radiation. So if we plot the spectrum of this, what we expect to get is the power per unit area per unit frequency varying as the temperature varies, in the sense that if we pick a particular temperature, let's say 1000 Kelvin, we have the spectrum observed to be something of this nature. And then if we, and that's the frequency of the black body radiation. So at a particular temperature, let's say 0 Kelvin. So now if we consider another particular temperature which is higher than this 1000 Kelvin, let's say 2000 Kelvin, what Planck actually observed was that as the temperature increases, the peak of the spectrum also shifts towards the right. That is, the peak of the spectrum also increases. Also increases, considering it in this form. So now what we can see from here is that the power per unit area per unit frequency varies directly, the peak of the spectrum varies directly proportional to the temperature of the electromagnetic radiation. And then with this, Planck was able to come up with the two basic laws that an approximation of the spectrum relation of Planck's formula. In the classical limit, if we consider the Planck's formula, which is this, we come up with two basic laws of the black body. The first one, which is the Wendt's displacement law. Actually, this law tells us how the spectrum of a black body varies as you vary the temperature. That is to say, if you consider the spectrum of a black body at a particular temperature, and when you consider it at another particular temperature, Wendt's law tells us how the frequency of the spectrum varies with the temperature. And in that case, you have the mu max all over the temperature equal to a constant, which is given as 0.58 times 10 joules per second. Considering this Wendt's law, which is a classical limit of Planck's formula, when the spectrum is being considered, we notice that for a particular temperature, the max of the spectrum has a particular value, and then by varying the temperature, again, we have a different max for the spectrum. This Wendt's law actually explains why you have a very hot body this Wendt's law displacement actually explains why a very hot body will have a very high frequency. And then the second classical limit of the Planck's formula, it's known as the Stefan-Boltzmann law. Stefan-Boltzmann's law actually tells us how the temperature, Stefan-Boltzmann's law actually tells us how the power per unit area of a black body radiation actually varies with the temperature of the body. And it's expressed as that is the power per unit area of the spectrum of the black body varies to the fourth power of the temperature. And this constant of proportionality is the Stefan-Boltzmann's constant, which has a particular value that our moment can remember. So now, considering the two classical limits of the Planck's law, actually, with these two laws, it can actually determine the frequency, in this case, maximum frequency of the spectrum of the black body radiation. And with this, we can actually tell how the power spectrum of the black body radiation varies with the temperature. These two results are the classical limits of Planck's formula. In the actual case, we know that every body actually radiates radiation with respect to its temperature, but there are certain bodies that cannot, whose temperature cannot actually be measured, and that is why we consider a black body. That is why we consider a model like the black body. A perfect role that the black body model plays in modern physics, Planck's formula to determine temperatures of celestial bodies that we cannot get access to. And then by measuring the power per unit area of the spectrum of such celestial bodies, we can actually determine the temperature of such bodies. On the Planck's formula, it's widely used in astronomy, whereby astronomers measure the spectrums of certain stars and then try to compare it with the Planck's formula. With these, they can actually determine the temperature of the star. And in 1974, Stephen Hawking made a comparison of the black hole with respect to the black body radiation. And then he said that the black hole can be likened to the black body. And then in that case, if it can be likened to that body, that the radiations from the black hole are also could be considered as black body radiations. And then in that case, that means we could like actually make use of the Planck's formula also to determine, we could actually make use of the Planck's formula also to determine the temperature of black body, of black holes also. And with this, I never to want to continue.
I need real, sorry. Real should be down. Sorry, for my plan, I need some clean blackboard. And finally, I found some clean blackboard. So Lauren and Robert presented us with some nice theory how to deal with thermodynamics. But all of this theory were in differential form, so we deal with some small changes of all quantities. But on the other hand, paper mentioned that we have, for example, water for which at pressure equal 1 bar, for example, we have temperature dependence of, for example, density, like till some point almost constant, then at 0 Kelvin Celsius we have change. And then again almost constant till the 100, and then almost a zero compared to the liquid water. So here's the question, how can we deal with such behavior of the matter in the terms of thermodynamics? And answer to this is to consider not the internal energy U as represented here, but free energy, which can be defined as the work which can be extracted from the system with in this state. This is defined as U minus TS. And since we know that at some particular state entropy is maximal, so that the equilibrium state of system is that state in which the free energy is minimal. And it's a function of state with parameters T, V, and maybe number of particles or numbers of particles, they are different. And this free energy behaves good, so it means that it's not taking some jumps when, for example, water density jumps. But how can we obtain the jumps of the density from this? We know the We can obtain it this way. The density is a derivative. And so while the f is continuous, its derivative can take the jumps. And this way we obtain the changes. Also, we know that there are some different phase transitions. For example, fluid superconductivity and so on. And in this case, we have no changes, for example, of the density, but we have some slighter changes. And those changes can be obtained from the free energy in the same way, but they will be different so that we can call them second kind change phase transition, because not the first derivative of the free energy taking the jump, but second order derivative. In some artificial models like XY model in two dimensions, we can also find some phase transition of higher orders. But all of them are described by behavior of free energy. How can we understand why does free energy behaves smoothly? And we can suppose that when we change slightly, for example, temperature, the microstate changes not so much, but how can we understand why does the density, for example, starts to change radically? We understand this that because the equilibrium state was the minimizing of all the free energy by the means of changing internal parameters. And for example, when we change the temperature in system, it could be so that microstate, which was corresponding to the minimal free energy, changes so that some other quite far from it microstate become the minimal state, the state of minimal free energy. And this way, the system rebuilds itself and goes to the completely different microstate, which corresponds to other, for example, density. What can be extracted from this? Well, each phase transition leads us to some new kind of state, so we can extract something new, some new properties of liquid or gas or solid or whatever. But the phase transitions themselves, for example, again, for simplest water, TP, we have different states and they behave something like this. And this is, of course, gas, solid, and liquid. And of course, we have some other phase transitions here of high orders between different structures in ice. And what we can extract not from the phases, but from phase transition is, for example, such interesting points, which allow us not only to fix the temperature scale at some particular pressure, but we, for example, can reproduce this amount of this number, this temperature, in each lab all over the world without having devices to measure pressure so exactly as we can obtain this temperature just by forcing water to find this true critical point, for example. And this gives us, again, new standards of temperature and so on. Thank you. I want to present some more of examples.
Well, we are already ahead of time, so how many time do I have? Okay. Okay, so I will talk about different interpretations of temperature that we have seen within the course of QFT2. In particular, I will talk about temperature as periodic imaginary time. This is something we saw at the beginning of QFT2 course. So the way we motivated it was, let us consider the time evolution operator in quantum mechanics. Well, I considered here that the Hamiltonian was depending on time. This is the operator. This is an operator. I consider the Hamiltonian dependent on time, but we normally just go to a static Hamiltonian. And then we rotate this time just for seeing what happens there, what is going on. Well, I will consider this static Hamiltonian from now on. So if we rotate it, if we redefine time as being purely imaginary, we find this object. And this object turns to be something that we are really familiar with. This is, except from this constant here, well, this time is not, if we interpret this as a constant, let we call it beta, this object is the object we are very familiar with. This is the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So, because the dependence is exactly the same one that we know about Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, let us try to exploit this analogy to further limits. So, in statistical mechanics, the thing we would like to compute is the partition function, and for a quantum statistical mechanics system, we will do it by taking the trace. So if we take the trace of this time evolution operator in Euclidean time, and this is taking the trace over the matrix elements of the operator, we find that we have this object, and this object is taking the definition of the partition function in statistical mechanics. But we saw that this object has some similarities with the partition function we studied in quantum mechanics or quantum field theory. But the difference is that we saw that we had here an initial and a final state. But if we consider that we are having periodic boundary conditions, this object is exactly the same. So somehow we are seeing that the partition function of our statistical system and the partition function of our path integral are exactly the same if we consider that if we change a time to imaginary time and consider periodic boundary conditions. I just motivate the analogy from the time evolution operator perspective, but this can be generalized to quantum field theories. So in a quantum field theory, we will define our path integral, and the weight will be something like this instead of our normal thing. And S Euclidean is defined to be So Euclidean, if this Lagrangian doesn't depend on time, we will automatically get a periodic time here, and we can interpret it as a quantum field theory at thermal equilibrium. So that is what we saw in quantum field theory 2 in the beginning, and it was really surprising at first, but somehow time and temperature have some similarities when we study static systems, or when we study thermodynamic equilibrium, the stability of these systems are very similar somehow. And intuitively, I don't know if it's well motivated, but it's the equation the fundamental quantum mechanics equation is the Schrödinger equation, and one of the fundamental equations in thermodynamics of non-equilibrium is the diffusion equation, and they are actually the same thing with a weak rotation. Let me do a quick example of how can we exploit this duality, this identity. Let me just remind you what is the Schwarzschild metric. And now what we want to do is to study how does this Schwarzschild metric behave if we consider Euclidean time. So, okay, and I will further go to near the horizon to see something that is really interesting. So if we change to some, we did it in an exercise in quantum field theory too, but if we consider Euclidean time and we go to these finite coordinates, the metric now is near the horizon, this metric. And here, this part of the metric is called Rindler space, but it's this metric is already very familiar to a lot of us because this is just polar coordinates. So somehow this is telling us that in this coordinates where this radial part is not singular, in these coordinates, the structure of our manifold has some periodicity in imaginary time. So now let me just write what is the period of this imaginary time. The period will be 2 pi over 4m. This is the period in imaginary time of our new metric. And now let me motivate what can we consider that this is the temperature. If we want to do a path integral in a Karsh manifold, if we do it in Minkowski space, it's ill-defined. But it turns out to be a little bit simpler in Euclidean space, so it will be the natural way to do it. But if we see here that if we go to Euclidean space, we will have to consider periodic boundary conditions for the scalars. So somehow we see here what is the structure of the manifold, and we are seeing here that we will have to consider these periodic conditions. So from the perspective of the path integral, we saw that these periodic conditions are giving us the temperature. That there is this theory is defining a quantum field theory at finite temperature. So this period in imaginary Euclidean time is something that it may seem really ad hoc, but you can show it by considering green functions and studying what is the spectrum profile, the radiation profile of our particles near the horizon, and you can show that in fact there is a black body radiation there. Although in asymptotic Minkowski, it's unstable. Okay, so this may seem a little bit weird, but there is a further insight that can help us or not to understand what does this radiation mean. And this is called the Unruh effect. The Unruh effect is a quantum field theory law that hasn't been observed, but it says that if we have an observer at constant acceleration in a quantum field theory, somehow the vacuum that this observer will see is not the same vacuum that we'll see an observer at rest. This vacuum will in fact be a thermal bath of particles. The way to find it is a little bit complicated because you have to do all these Bolyai-Glove transformations and all these things we saw in condensed matter. But the thing is that it's easy to show that near the horizon, a geodesic observer will move the geodesics near the horizon will be something like a constant acceleration trajectories. So with this, knowing this Unruh effect, okay, I will write it what this is. Knowing that this Unruh effect is there and that this vacuum near the horizon of the black hole will be really quantum mechanical, because an observer that will go near the horizon, he won't know that the horizon is there. But somehow, if we understand this observer as being at constant acceleration because of the effect of the black hole, we can justify the Hawking temperature from like coming from the shift on the vacuum, on this Unruh temperature. And then let me just mention that this temperature coming from the Unruh effect is extremely little. For example, if the acceleration of the observer is 10 to the 22 meters over second square, the temperature he will feel is 1 degree Kelvin. So. Thank you.